All right, so welcome. So this image, so for those of you who are joining us, we're going through this 10 images of called the ox herding pictures. So it's a way of exploring, depicting, showing the spiritual practice and how it changes, how it evolves over time. And this picture, I'm going to just turn off my video so you can see those online. You can see there, maybe you could highlight me there, Beth. And if you can't see it, it's basically a picture of a Buddha-like person. Seems very happy, very blissful, but also really raggedy. You know, ragged clothes, barefoot. But also the key thing is going back into the market, back into the world, into the village, into life. So let's reconnect. Lose that again. Great. So this image, in some ways, it's the culmination of this whole practice, this whole way we've been exploring. I remember one of the LDLs, I think it was Lauren, said that originally they only had like 9 pictures and they added this extra one, this coming back into our daily life, back into the world. So I want to highlight that tonight, talking about this theme of trends of integration of our practice into our lives. Because this image of the Buddha coming in, it can be, on one hand, very aspiring. It's like, oh, this is where the practice is leading. This is what I have, that potential. And if it has that effect on you, if it draws you forward in your practice, helps you have that sense of really seeing more and more deeply, then that's served its purpose. But on the other hand, if you look at that picture of the Buddha and say, wow, that is so far from where I am, you know, it seems unattainable. You know, think this lifetime, maybe I can't do it, maybe some future lifetimes, then it becomes maybe less beneficial. So I want to talk about that and also just talk about this sense of how do we integrate our daily life into our spiritual practice? How does it actually show up in our day-to-day activities, how we work, how we live, how we're around relationships? We're going into this kind of intensive holiday seasons, however we might celebrate that. And often there's time around family, which can be wonderful, but as we all know, sometimes not quite so wonderful at times, depending on how those relationships are. So integration. And sometimes we have trouble integrating our insights, our wisdom, our compassion into our life because of this, well, I'm going to call it spiritual idealism. Okay, what we think we should be as a spiritual practitioner. So we kind of, not realizing we take on that identity, we're setting aside some things. Okay, a spiritual person isn't angry. They're not jealous. They're not lustful. They're not whatever you're greedy, whatever you might put into that. And so those aspects of ourselves then become pushed down, repressed. So this doesn't serve us. This doesn't serve our practice, doesn't serve our opening, our awakening. And however we might be in our practice, whether we've had these deep realizations or we're just starting off in the practice, each one of us has some way that the practices start to change the way we see ourselves and see ourselves in the world. It may be small ways, it may be very profound ways, but how do those actually show up in our daily life? And sometimes if we get caught in this idea of what the Buddha was, what he represents, and how far away that is, it has this effect of discouraging ourselves, discouraging our practice, and also has this way of judging ourselves. Okay, we're not up to that task. We're not up to the idealism of the Buddha. Now, the Buddha, as I mentioned last week, you know, I hold him as an ordinary flesh and blood human being that just had some very profound insights, some very profound seeing that was incredibly transformational. And yet he was still a human being. And he learned how to work with all his humanness. And then that way transformed it. Now, I think what we look at the suttas now and how we hold the Buddha, we've kind of lost some of that humanness, even though some of the suttas have the Buddha yelling at people and cursing them out and telling them how stupid they might be and how he might at different times be more scared or more sad. Those are just here and there. We have this sense that the Buddha is just always very in repose. You know, our statues of the Buddha, our images of the Buddha always have that idealism. One commentary I was reading talked about how the Buddha was so pure that dirt would not literally stick to his skin. Right? It would just kind of slough off like some kind of super Teflon capacity. But he would still take baths so people would, you know, feel like he was part of the gang or something like that. I think that's, you know, it's not so helpful to have such a big difference. If, you know, if we're really devotional, then that's maybe that is wonderful. It's a very helpful aspect. But again, if we see that the Buddha is something so beyond our ordinary humanness, I wonder how helpful that is. Because that sense of idealism can rob us of this capacity to really meet ourselves where we are. To meet how I am in this contracted mind, in this difficult mind state. How do I actually meet that? I'm so busy saying I shouldn't be having this because it denies my spirituality, my depth of understanding, then that's a problem. That makes it hard to integrate into our lives. Now, another way I've noticed that's hard to integrate practice is when we get stuck in our mode of practice. You see this really clearly at the end of a retreat that, you know, we've been practicing, there's a container, there's all your, you know, obligations have been set aside. We do that in a small way in the meditation, okay? You set aside your cell phones, you try to have a secluded quality of attention, just meeting your moment's experience, just how it is. But you can imagine doing that over multiple days, how that starts to develop this momentum. So a common question is, well, how do I carry that home? How do I stay this mindful in the midst of my kids and my relationships, my work, just the world and all its pulls and struggles? And it's impossible to really, because there's that container of the retreat is what held it. So what we get stuck on is how the practice is, we think it's supposed to look, and we lose the capacity to adapt to how life is. Now, the moment-to-moment attention, like feeling this breath, feeling this sensation, letting go of everything else, that if we're doing more of the type of kind of exclusive practice, excluding everything else except the object, or even if we're doing more of an open practice, that we're just sitting, watching things arise and come and pass away without having to do anything with, that doesn't work as easily in daily life when people do want to know what you think about things. You do have to make choices about what to have for dinner and how to vote and how to do this and that. So some ways to help with that is to have a sense of noting the expression of emotionality as a body sensation. So the subtle ways that shows up. Sometimes we get stuck in the big fireworks that when we're really angry, really scared. But if we really tune into it, there's a constant little quality of emotionality that's kind of floating through the body sensations. If we start to bring that to our awareness, I found that's very helpful being in daily life. I can notice as I'm having a conversation, what's going on internally. As I say the words, as I hear the words, as I see the interaction, I can see where I start to tighten up, when I contract, when I relax, when I open. And that becomes this beautiful guide and feedback loop between acting, speaking, thinking, and that internal quality. We start to notice that when we get, like the precepts are a more strong example, that we start to push against the precepts, there's often this internal noise, internal tension that starts to arise. And we start to learn that, to see that in more and more subtle ways. Like just something as simple as speaking what's true. We can notice when we start to push against that edge, there's an internal echo of that. There's an internal ramification of that. And we attend to that. And we learn how to start to navigate through life by sensing that and becoming more and more aligned. Also, just the simple quality of being a little embodied, feeling your feet, feeling yourself sitting as you're speaking, as you're interacting, as you're doing your work. This is very helpful, just to have that little bit of grounding. One teacher described it as just keeping about 10 or 20% of your awareness in your body as you're speaking. So as I'm doing that right now, as I'm talking to you, I'm feeling the contact of my feet on the ground, and feeling the contact of my rear on this chair, and feeling the sense of the air touching the ground. So just a light contact, but I can focus mostly on how I'm conveying, feeling how that internal milieu is feeling. Does it feel clean? Does it feel aligned? Or does it feel like it's a little off? And so start to notice that. And if I lose that contact, I've also tend to be more into reactivity. Well, if I just focused on, okay, I'm feeling just my feet, I lose the capacity to interact, to really dance with life, to dance with what's arising. So hopefully you got to get a sense. This is what I tend to do in my own practice. And hopefully it's helpful. Just as you're living your life, whatever expression that might be, with dear friends, with loved ones, with strangers, washing the dishes, have a little broader attention. So you're also sensing the environment, sensing the internal experience, and just noticing what arises. It's amazing just how much noticing itself starts to transform, starts to allow us to have greater understanding. That in turn brings this cycle of insight into our daily life. Life starts to become this place that we learn from. Because in a meditation retreat or on your own formal practice, we are in many ways kind of isolating ourselves. We're kind of, okay, I'm going to slit aside everything else. Of course, it has its internal echoes that may still carry through. But it's different than actually talking to someone and being present. That interactions that creates a friction or a rub that shows us often where we're still kind of stuck. We learn to turn toward that with curiosity, with interest, with spaciousness. We actually start to learn from it. And then our insights, you know, we start to really open up in really profound ways. This actually leads to the third point around integrating our practice into our lives. And that is around our insights, our wisdom. So insights could be, that's, you know, insight meditation is a way we see life in a different way. We see ourselves, we see the nature of suffering, we see the nature of impermanence, we see the nature of the sense of self, the three characteristics, the four noble truths. These all, we start to see them in our own experience. So how do those show up in our lives? How do they actually inform ourselves? So sometimes we can use it in a very, intentional way. Like I'm going to practice working with one of the precepts. Let's say the precept of right speech, of not speaking falsehoods. So I notice every time I have a little edge around that, a little bit of kind of hedging my bets a little bit, and I bring a lot of curiosity to it. Or maybe it's around the Four Noble Truths, or what are the Noble Truths? You know, finding whatever strikes, makes your ear perk up, and bringing that into your life. And the other way, it's just this interesting, this is a deeper way that our practice works. And this is the transformation that happens, that we just find that we actually are different in our lives. Without intending to do it, without trying to change it, that something has fallen away that used to be present. You know, typically around our patterns of reactivity, our patterns of judgment, perhaps, or patterns of comparison, something just starts to fall away. Right? And what's happening is that the practice is starting to teach us that this idea of me, of myself, and all the constructs around that are actually much looser than we ever thought they were. Just because we keep re-practicing, re-enhancing them, re-upping them. That's why they seem so solid. Well, you sit down and practice and just feeling your breath, feeling sensations, the sense of you becomes less established, becomes less formed. It starts to quiet down. Okay, that's what practice is designed to teach us. You know, from my own lens and my teacher's lens, that sense of self is perhaps the kernel, the key piece of all of the Buddha's teachings. Okay, so let's fast forward a couple of days here in Thanksgiving time. You know, that famous quote, I've been using that too much, but that Ram Dass, I think, said, if you think you're awakened, go spend a week with your family, right? Because your family represents how you first learn to have a sense of self. You know, you learned how to have, let's say, you know, all of the negative sides of things, the shame, the embarrassment, the way you compensate, out of all the positive aspects too. But those are ways that you, as a child, we learn how to create that sense of self. And it's really embedded in how we mesh up with people. Part of it's our dysfunction, part of it's our conditioning, you know, part of it is our archaic wounding, perhaps trauma, all these aspects. And so we'd be around our family, it's like that comes right back up, or at least it can. That your sister knows exactly what to say to just drive you out of your mind. Just like that little bit, like that seems such a benign comment. But if you knew that person for your whole life, you would know too much of a trigger that is. Same thing with our brothers, our sisters, our parents, our children. And so can be a joyous time, but also can be a really tender time. You know, so how this is what's it's showing us our conditioning. And you might find that sometimes you go home and you expect, okay, there's going to be this, or people come to your home depending on what your circumstances are, that something has fallen away, that you're not reactive in the same way, that some, like it's like a piece of code, like in programming, some piece is missing, so the end result doesn't arise in the same way. Right? You've unhooked part of that dependent origination. That process of selfing isn't so strong. So start to notice that when that happens and just be willing to be undefined. Actually say, wow, if I'm not being triggered in the same way, how do I actually relate to people? How do I relate to this person? That's what this whole picture is about. Coming back into the marketplace, coming back into our lives. So sometimes it just falls, things fall away. You don't even realize why they've fallen away or how they have. You just notice that there's something that's missing, not in a way that's a lack, but actually in a way that has alleviated some element of suffering. Other times you might bring one of these insights right to the forefront. Yeah, I'm going to really practice speaking only what's true with everything I say on Thanksgiving Day. I'm going to practice perhaps renunciation. I'm going to practice noticing the craving mind. Whatever the point is, endless possibilities. What's important is what brings you alive in your practice. That's the secret of integration, is that passion, that interest. And, you know, teachers can point to that. They can try to fan those flames, but you have to have that flame. You have to have that interest. And you have that flame. I'm seeing Rob's fireplace behind him. That's great. So that flame, if it comes, you know, that flame is alive. When you breathe on it, when you bring energy to it, then your practice deepens. And then there's this beautiful returning of cycle, that the insights of our practice, our deepening of our practice, and our daily lives really start to work in concert. They work together. And then there's no sense of separation in that. We go on retreat, we practice formally each day, that deepens our practice. You know, the things that come up in life, we bring into that practice. We come back into our lives, what we learn on the cushion comes back. So suddenly there becomes not such a big distinction. Just to the different modes of practice, different ways. And above all, a key thing is to release our idealism to simply, this is how I am right now. Maybe I have been more wise in the past, maybe more compassionate, but right here, this is the humanness that's right in this moment, and meeting that with as much open-heartedness as you can. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. All right, so as we move into a little break before the small groups, just calling your attention to the Donna baskets, both here in the room and also online, that Sims and myself really depend upon your support, whatever is appropriate for yourself. And we'll come back and do small groups of about 4 to 5 people, both online and also in person. All right, finding your way back to your seat. All right, so I'll talk about the topic, but let's have those in person go and find about, let's do groups of 4 to 5 people. And Jackie, just hold off on putting people in a group till I can tell them what it's going to be about. All right, so here's the topic of discussion. So it's basically this key thing of how do we integrate our spiritual practice into our daily lives? In which areas do you find that that's been, you know, fairly easy or successful at? And which areas have been more difficult? And why? You know, what is the difficulty around? What's the success around? What makes it easy to integrate? What makes it harder to integrate? And speak from your own, you know, direct experience, you know, try to have as much, concrete ways of explaining it to your partners. And these groups are just, they're not a time to offer suggestions or to try to teach each other, but really just to listen deeply to what you have to share. And so you practice speaking from your direct experience and receiving that as fully and as completely as you can. All right, so let's give that a try. We'll do this for about 20 minutes. Does that make sense? Any questions about the topic? How you integrate your life, your Dharma practice. What makes it easy? What makes it hard? All right, so go ahead and start. And those online, we'll put you into some small groups. All right, so we have some chance now for any sharing or questions you might have around integrating your practice, how that works, what that looks like. What did you share, what you discussed and what you explored? So those online, you're welcome to unmute. Actually, let's have you raise your hands or so we can manage that a little bit better. You can raise your virtual hand, and those in person, you can raise your physical hand. What do you guys discuss? What do you do? What works well? What's the struggle? Yes, Beth, do you want to come up so they can hear you online?
Well, when I read the homework sheet, which I don't know where I put it, I've mindlessly lost it over there somewhere, where it says something, problems, areas where you're having difficulty integrating into your life. Mm. I knew exactly what it was. It's like, yeah, I don't want to think about that. And the area is, and we were talking in our group, and I wasn't alone. is entertainment. I am addicted to entertainment. My name is Beth, and I'm an addict, and I'm addicted to entertainment. And I have been for 59 years. And, I am a movie buff. I'm a music buff. My husband's an audiophile. We go to concerts. I have to structure over now. I don't watch TV that much, but I enjoy reading and I'm not going to stop. I know I'm not. I've been doing this for 16 years. I haven't stopped yet. I'm not going to now. So thank you.
All right. Well, hang out there a little bit, Beth. Let's see. I'll switch back here. All right. So what's the rub? What's the issue with entertainment?
Well, that's where the spiritual idealism comes in, right?
Oh.
I'm draining. I'm not crying. So I'm too happy because I'm thinking about all the things I'm entertained by. But it's the spiritual, a good yogi would not be, these ephemeral, meaningless things would not hold for me anymore because I'd be so concentrated that I wouldn't need any of it to distract me. That's the idealist. That's the belief, the should.
Yeah, so that can definitely be I'm kind of trying to manage those. This for the online people. That's the idealism is certainly a big friction point, right? So it tends to, and what does that do when you feel that idealism?
I feel like a bad girl.
Yeah, so it adds a level of judgment.
A bad student.
Yeah, bad student, meditator.
Yeah, I need to be really careful. I mean, I have a playlist for leaving Sims. It's so really cool with music for leaving Sims.
That's great. So in terms of you said something interesting.
I'm going to hell.
Yeah. You have to be careful. Is that that you'll be found out or?
I don't have much pretense about myself, but I feel it's kind of a psychopathic thought. I feel like I should feel guilty, but I actually don't. Because I do practice mindfulness. I do meditate every day. I do,
All right. So let's set aside the guilt piece and idealism. What, if any, is the detriment?
I think, I don't have the guilt, so I don't, that's easy. I feel like, I'm getting older and I feel I don't want to say achievement because I've kind of let go of that too, but I just feel like the continuity of my practice is at risk. I feel I love my practice and I want to take care of it. And I don't want to, those hints of freedom I love, and I don't want to compromise access to that with my love affair of entertainment.
How does it compromise it?
Well, it compromises it. I can see the signs and the symptoms because when I do go on retreat, the concentration is so much greater, right? And I feel that after retreat, that sort of, this is great. I'm not going to have a Diet Coke anymore and everything's going to be wonderful and there's been no television. And then homeostasis comes back and has its way. And I guess it is idealism still, that the thought that as I get older and I get more mature in the practice, then that won't be a temptation to me.
So what I'm doing is I'm I'm just kind of unpacking it a little bit, because it's a strong pattern, of course, I think for many of us, and not only the pattern of entertainment, but also the judgment around that and assumptions around it. I remember, hopefully you won't mind if I said this, I remember Joseph Goldstein telling my teacher training group, like, if you guys know of any really good spy mystery novels, let me know. Because that's kind of, you know, you look like Joseph, he's been practicing a long time, but he still enjoys that. Another, you know, very awakened teacher likes to play poker and, you know, listen to music. So it's, that's why that, you know, where exactly is the detriment? Where is the rub actually there? And if it's just the imposer of like, well, you know, that's not what you should do if you're spiritual, that's not enough. You have to really see where the rub is, if there is one. Because I think it's much less, we can certainly get in areas that I was going to say, much less, not so much what we do, but more how that, what that elicits in us. There's certainly some actions which are going to be much more harmful, obviously, that we want to be aware of and work with. But something like entertainment, just start to notice yourself. There's a couple of things I would be curious about. You know, again, you're not saying don't enjoy that, but notice sometimes what's the impulse to want to do that. And just kind of pause there for a little bit being like a couple minutes, and just notice what's your internal experience. Okay. Now, sometimes I wonder how many people have experienced this after a meditation. You know, you feel settled, you feel grounded, or after a retreat. And what's the first thing you do is you open the refrigerator, or you try to check your email, or you do something that's a little bit more engaging, right? So just to notice if that's part of what goes on. Because part of what happens is we get less formed, just form ourselves back up. Just noticing it, not judging it or changing it, but just notice that. Other part is just, you know, notice the echoes. Because sometimes I watch, you know, when I watch different shows, sometimes the content is very gripping, very powerful in a way that, you know, I just don't like how it changes my mind. It changes, you know, there's a residue in it that's not so helpful. And you notice that. Other ones that open you to this capacity of being human in a deeper way. It's like, wow, this is really poignant. So just start to bring more awareness to it. So if you stop judging it, you can actually see it more clearly.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Right. What else is out there? Yeah, Alan, go ahead.
Yeah. So my group talked in some different ways on the topic at hand about being open or being interested in kind of like the rub or being triggered, and how that, you know, kind of taking that into practice. I was talking about, you know, my practice being sometimes pursuing, kind of pursuing being triggered. And others were just talking about things, how they're, you know, respond to triggered and just kind of being more open to it. And just, not that the interest makes it go away or the interest, you know, makes it not triggering, but something about that being, you know, kind of brought in as the practice, it does transform it a bit, because then when something happens that's really triggering, it's kind of like, oh, okay, you know, now is my time to kind of pay attention and see what this is all about.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things is when we get triggered, do we use that as a way of kind of confirming and reinforcing the sense of me, that sense of hurt and the sense of conditioning? Or do we use it as a way to start to unpack that or start to dissolve that? So that's a big distinction, because if we're still in that sense of every time I get triggered, every time I get criticized, every time I get judged, every time I fail, every time I succeed, and then I'm more likely to fail after that, whatever those patterns are, if it all comes back to this core sense of me, that in a way that we can look at it in a way that reinforces that sense of me, that makes it actually more entrenched stronger, more established. Those are all going to be unpleasant, distressing experiences. It's like, why tell me, why don't give me feedback, because that tells me how bad I am. You know, it reinforces that. Versus if we start to see through those patterns, we actually see those patterns not as being something I don't have to pay attention to, but actually see the identification, see through that aspect of it. Then it's like we realize, well, I'm getting feedback, I'm feeling defensive. Isn't that interesting? Here I am forming myself in a way that, you know, I know from my other experiences, from my own other seeing, that that's not completely true. That's not absolutely true. That's an arbitrary selfing, an arbitrary way I'm forming around that. And so, okay, well, how can I see through that? How can I open to that? How can I see what I'm not believing? That's what I was doing with Beth, is asking, you know, here's this pattern. There's the superficial part of it, but what's the assumptions? What's the beliefs behind that? And if we do it in a way that actually starts to loosen those beliefs and loosen that establishment of self, then that feedback, even those times we get triggered, become gifts. We really see that as a gift.
So it can be like a, what's the word? Or if it comes up, one way to work is, how am I selfing in this moment? Or how is this making me feel as a self?
Yeah, I think the first step is just kind of a full-hearted acknowledgement of what's present. Because we kind of jump sometimes to the Dharma question. Sometimes we can skip over those kind of tender parts. It's like, okay, what's really here? What's, you know, I don't care. Anyone who sees it knows it. Let me just see for myself what is actually present. And so you develop this really exquisite honesty with yourself. And, you know, hopefully coupled with a quality of exquisite compassion. Like, okay, I meet this. And then from there, yeah, that where am I forming to that sense of me? You know, a lot of it is noticing by contrast when you're not so formed, how that feels, what that subjective experience is like versus when you get formed. It's like it gets solid. It gets like, you know, everything's codified. There's a, you know, solidity or rigidity to it. Versus this fluidity when we're not so formed.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Alan. All right, back here in person, anyone like to ask or share anything? Back online, anyone online, you can just raise your hand when you're ready. And same thing here in the room. All right. Tamara was right. I was going to say, looks like your cat is raising its hand.
Kind of piggybacking off Alan a little bit, what we were talking about in our group was that place where we have... we're talking about meows. We're talking about that place where we have difficulty bringing the practice in. And one of the things we were talking about was just those moments, you know, you said something at the end of your talk about, you know, being really human or something. And those moments where we're really struggling and being really human and something's come up and maybe we're not on our best behavior and really struggling to bring the practice into that moment, to be kind to ourselves and gentle and compassionate. And I just thought it was interesting how, you know, we all, that resonated with all of us as a place where we struggle.
Yeah. So there's times that we struggle, we don't have as, you know, access to our deeper level of wisdom or compassion. And I think often, you know, that first point around idealism, it's like sometimes it's just we have to acknowledge that this is a hard experience. This is just a painful experience. This is not my preference in any shape, form, way, or form. And yet this is how the moment's presenting itself. So that's like that kind of, that deep honesty, like, okay, I'm really noticing that. And sometimes by doing that, you realize, well, I'm trying to, you know, I don't know what's the right word, trying to make myself be what I'm not. And sometimes it's just a very practical thing. Like I just need to take a break. I need to go rest. I need to go watch a movie and you know, have a way of a respite from my experience. Sometimes I think we hold this such a strong idealism that we should just plow through no matter what is going on. And, you know, we start to learn over time that there's a saying in Japanese culture, sometimes the quicker way is to go the long way around instead of going right through things. So just taking that, okay, I'm going to just take some time to really care for myself, nurture myself, maybe have a conversation, maybe have some way of drawing a boundary instead of thinking somehow if I was seeing in the right way, things would magically open up. That happens, but we don't want to forget our very practical skills as a human being. Does that, I don't know if that addresses what you're saying, but hopefully, what else?
Yeah, I think it does. I think what we were talking about was sort of being in those difficult moments and berating ourselves and saying, oh, I've been practicing for so long, I should be able to handle this better, rather than just saying, as you said, oh, this is a difficult moment, and acknowledging that it's a difficult moment and letting it be that way and doing what needs to happen in the moment to self-soothe and to be gentle.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I mean, those of you who have been on retreat with me, I like to do that bell practice from walking, like walking meditation. You hear the bell, and the practice is you just stop whatever you're doing, right? And just pause. So here's a practice for all of you. Every time you hear yourself saying or thinking the word should, hear the bell and pause, right? I should be better. I should, as soon as you hear yourself saying that, use that as a temple bell to call yourself back into pause. Because it's easy to just follow that should and just kind of get lost on that. Yeah, and eventually we have to unpack that and might as well do it when it's small. Hear that should, pause. Right, thank you.
Thank you,
Tara. All right, maybe one more before we have some announcements. Yeah, Carlito.
Let's see. So the integration of practice into the real world. It's both a positive and a negative for me, but one of the outcomes of practice for me is heightened sensitivity. So I already kind of sensitive to begin with. So like encountering an angry person in the grocery store or something, I really feel the energy, pick up the energy. And so that's maybe one of the, I don't know if negative is the right word, but it's a more challenging aspect of practice. And then on the flip side, I can feel what my sister is feeling or what my daughter's feeling more intimately or what I'm feeling, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that integration between practice and not me, I guess one of the things I see a lot and deal with a lot in terms of that going back into the marketplace. So it's not really a question. I guess it's just a comment. But anyway, I thought I'd share that.
Thank you, Carlito. Yeah, that sensitivity, you know, that the practice does make us. Sorry, you guys are just looking at some empty chairs. There I am. It makes us much more sensitive and open, which has its pluses and minuses. We are much more available to ourselves, to people we want to be available to, and we're also available to everything. You know, so learning how to navigate that. So that statement about really noticing what the whole picture of what's here. So if your example being in the grocery store and there's someone who's really angry and just their energy is going all out and you really feel that. Okay, noticing what, you know, your own reaction is to that. Okay, there's the fear, there's being out of balance, you know, and just, okay, that's part of this moment's experience. And by doing that, eventually you start to kind of work through some of that, you know, being frozen or that sense of overwhelm, and maybe start to find access to compassion, to a sense of, oh, this person is suffering and this is coming out in this angry way. You know, and there's also the discernment about noticing, okay, what's appropriate, what's safe, what's safer in terms of that interaction. And maybe you turn to someone else and say, well, that was really they're having a hard day. You know, so you start to kind of work through that initial reaction. So again, acknowledging that and seeing that clearly, you know, okay, this is what's happening in my system. My system's overwhelmed by this. And we've talked about in other, you know, talks around how to have that sense of boundaries, a sense of grounding, a sense of integration. So just start to notice when you feel overwhelmed, you know, can you feel your feet? Can you feel your breath? Can you, if the energy is too much, can you let it go past you so you're not being absorbing it so much?
Yeah. Thank you, Jan. Both of those things happen. I mean, yeah, it's like, oh man, that's so sad, and you feel the compassion.
Yeah.
Other times it's like, okay, I'm putting up a wall.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlito. All right. So thank you all. And next week we'll offer a fuller talk on this topic, and then we'll move into the last month and the last kind of a recap, kind of looking at the whole, I know we've gone through each picture month by month. Now let's look back at how this whole thing works together in terms of the Oxfording pictures. All right. Thank you.